The first time photographer Angelo Marandino met Jennifer, he knew that she was the one right away. They fell in love and got married in New York Central Park, surrounded by family, friends, and loved ones. 5 months later, Jen was diagnosed with breast cancer. From Angelo's blog, I remember the exact moment, Jen's voice and the numb feeling that enveloped me. That feeling has never left. I'll also never forget how we looked into each other's eyes and held each other's hands. We are together. We'll be okay. Throughout her battle, Angelo decided to photograph it. He wanted to humanize the face of cancer on the face of his wife. And the photos that he took really speak for themselves. I'm sorry that a technological glitch is preventing me from being able to show you how beautiful they are. And I hope that you can see them. Maybe we'll put them on the Fellowship's Facebook page, and we'll include them in the sermon text when that becomes available. But you see images of a happy couple drinking beer in the park and kayaking together. And then you see the IV drip of the chemotherapy drugs. And then you see more and more time spent in hospitals, a head being shaved, and then finally, Jen's beautiful, simple tombstone with the inscription simply, "I loved it all." Powerful images. The spiritual challenge of vulnerability, which is our theme this month, involves more than just accepting that we are vulnerable. Often, the human spirit calls us to take the unexpected or painful events of our lives and make something beautiful out of them. This doesn't mean that everything happens for a reason, and it doesn't mean that we have to be glad for a tragedy we have been forced to endure. Instead, says Scott Taylor, the Unitarian Universalist minister who created our monthly theme structure, living a life of vulnerability means having a faith stance which trusts that grace is woven into even the darkest of events. That's a tall order, but he offers some hints at how to approach the task. In this month's Journey Group resource packet, one of the spiritual homework options is to make or honor something beautiful from what's been broken. So here are the instructions. Think about something that was broken, lost, or painful in your own experience, and then do something to pull the grace from it. Make or find an object that helps tell the story of your efforts. Maybe you've already had an experience of creating or discovering beauty out of what was broken. And if that's true, then honor that experience once again by symbolizing the beauty you discovered or created. I've seen a lot of this grace pulled from hardship during the last couple weeks, when we lost three prominent and well-loved members of our fellowship community. My favorite part of each of the unique funerals and memorial services was the open sharing time, when everyone present was invited to tell brief memories and stories about the person who had died. This is a human impulse to honor the lives of those we care about, and it is, in fact, a way to honor our own lives, too. Roger and I have heard from many of you this week that attending David's and Les's and Margaret's services have called to many of your minds questions about how you yourself might be remembered when the inevitable comes. I don't mean that it's inevitable that we each will die, although that's true. I mean that it's inevitable that people will remember us. Will desire to honor our lives in some way, however great or small. So it makes sense to think about that every now and then while we're still alive. Maybe you have a favorite song or reading you would like to know would be included in a celebration of your life. Or you know something you definitely don't want, like a certain someone in charge of the planning, or a bouquet of your least favorite flowers. Leaving information is not only helpful for your loved ones, but it increases your chances of being memorialized in ways that will be meaningful to you. On April 2nd, I'm going to lead a workshop about this. It'll be a one-time evening called Putting the You in Your Memorial Service. At this event, we'll talk about some of the options, and then everyone who wishes to do so will have a chance to indicate on a form some of their personal preferences. Of course, you can update or change this at any time. Nothing is written in stone. But the fellowship will retain this information. We'll keep that form on file. And then we'll also invite you to save the information and share it with the people in your life. If you feel that this might be a useful event for you in your own thinking and planning process, then please RSVP at the sign-up spot in the corner of our front lobby. This is not only a practical task, although I'll echo what Roger said a few weeks ago when he preached about his own funeral arrangements, which is to urge you to consider estate planning and creating a living will if you haven't already done so. These may seem like pesky logistics, but they're also how we spiritually acknowledge that we are all vulnerable to death. That probably doesn't sound exactly fun, but paradoxically, this kind of preparation that puts us in touch with our fundamental vulnerability can also leave us feeling just strong enough to live in the face of the unknown. And yet, not every death can or should be anticipated. After all, even a young and healthy person can get breast cancer while still a newlywed. And how is that fair? During our recent run of loss here at the fellowship, when I was hearing all the stories, meeting family of the deceased I hadn't met before, my head and my heart kept returning to someone who's been in the news recently, Jordan Davis. Jordan was a 17-year-old high school student in Jacksonville, Florida, very near where I used to live before I came to Appleton. He was shot to death by Michael Dunn, a 45-year-old white male software developer who was visiting that city for a wedding. The incident began when Dunn asked Jordan and his friends, who were all African American, to turn down their music. And the kids tried to leave, but Dunn fired 9 bullets into their car. This is all in the news again now the past couple weeks, you may have noticed, because the jury was unable to return a verdict. So for now, Dunn is free. Well, Jordan is dead. Understandably, this case has been compared to the stalking and shooting death of another African-American child, Trayvon Martin, which also happened in Florida, and also left free the older white man who was responsible. How might we make sense of this tragedy then? Well, the Reverend John Guns and his Baptist church in Jacksonville made headlines when he was preaching. And he noticed a young man in his congregation who was wearing a hoodie, like Trayvon Martin was when George Zimmerman killed him. And so the pastor brought the kid up on stage and told him that whenever he went into a store, he needed to take the hood off. Better that than to wind up dead. Clearly, the pastor wanted to protect the youth in his church, maybe as his way of making or honoring something beautiful from what's been broken. But Tanya Weathersby, columnist at TheRoot.com, has another perspective. She writes, "To be sure, that advice is sound and pragmatic. And a lot of black parents who love their children are probably repeating it. I understand it," she says, "but I don't like it." Why doesn't she like it? because she says that a focus on keeping black kids safe sidesteps the real issue, which is that racism is violent. Writing in The Atlantic, Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about what it means to be in a community where your children are targeted for violence based on who they are. That's vulnerability if I ever heard a definition of it. In the aftermath of Jordan Davis's murder, Coates talks about the vulnerability of being himself brown-skinned and having brown-skinned children who must be taught to not wear hoodies or listen to loud music or talk back or even dare to seek help after a random car accident, to name just a few incidents in the last couple years that have made the news when they led to white people taking the lives of black people, most of whom were actually children under the age of 18. So Coates' version, the journalist who writes for The Atlantic, his version of making and honoring something beautiful from what's been broken is to demand structural change. And he's not the kind of person who sugarcoats it. He says that this kind of tragedy will keep happening because our heritage isn't colorblind. Our legacy in this country, he says, and when he says ours, he's talking about black people. Our legacy is to die in this land where time is unequal and deeded days are unequal. And blessed is the black man who lives to learn other ways, who lives to see other worlds, who lives to bear witness before the changes. I know that's not easy personally for me to hear, but I think what he's saying is that vulnerability can interrupt life, sometimes fatally. Jordan Davis was vulnerable to fate and to other factors too, like racism. Our monthly theme asks one very specific question about this. What does it look like to live a life of vulnerability? For me, it means looking at the world with an interest in and a commitment to seeing other people's vulnerabilities. What is it like to notice that other people are not impenetrable fortresses, but human beings that experience pain and brokenness, like Jennifer, whose husband took beautiful pictures of her as she was dying, or like Jordan, who was just listening to music with friends, or like our own dear Cindy, who heard some hard news from her beloved son? What is it like to witness vulnerability, including our own, and then dare to wonder how we might make something beautiful from it? Even whole nations can take on such a practice of grace. Remember the Norwegian massacre in 2011, when right-wing extremist Anders Behring Breivik killed 77 people because he felt that the government was encouraging acceptance of Islam? Almost 70 of the people who died were children at a government-sponsored summer camp. Well, memorial plans have just been unveiled, and I really urge you to Google the images because they're really incredible. The artist, the Swedish artist of this project, Jonas Dahling, has unveiled plans to cut from the island on which the summer camp was a whole slice of land and remove it so that you see surrounded by water a empty passageway through the jut of land, and to write in stone that will line the emptiness the names of each person who perished. So the artist says about this, "It should be difficult to see the inherent beauty of the setting without also experiencing a sense of loss of that which is no longer there, the people symbolized by the removal of the strip of land." So the artist says, it is this sense of loss that will physically activate the site. And the piece is going to be titled Memory Wound. Isn't that an evocative definition of vulnerability? Lucia McBath is an individual person, not a whole country, but a person, who is also determined to make and honor something beautiful from what's been broken. She is Jordan Davis's mother. Recently, she told the press, I forgive Michael Dunn, but it doesn't negate what I'm feeling and my anger. And I am allowed to feel that way. But more than that, I have a responsibility to God to walk the path he's laid. In spite of my anger and my fear, I am still called by the God I serve to walk this out. And then from that calling to walk her path, she has wisdom for all of us who might wish to make a world where kids like hers are less vulnerable. She says, it doesn't matter how educated we've become. It doesn't matter because there is still an issue of race in this country. No, we have not really arrived. If something like this can happen, we have not arrived. And so later in this same conversation, she addresses what I think is the opposite of vulnerability, strength. The journalist with whom she is meeting has brought along his own son, an African-American boy around Jordan Davis's age. And so Lucia McBath looks at the youth and she tells him, you exist. You matter. You have value. You have every right to wear your hoodie, to play your music as loud as you want. You have every right to be you. And no one should deter you from being you. You have to be you, and you can never be afraid of being you. Isn't that what makes us stronger? To be seen in our vulnerability and recognized as worthy, even beautiful. Maybe our first Unitarian Universalist principle is about just these moments. When we are especially vulnerable, for whatever reason, being reassured of our inherent worth and dignity might help us restore or at least cling to strength. I can't imagine Lucia McBath's strength of character, considering all that she has been through the last couple years. But somehow, and I think in her speaking to this young kid, she is finding a way of making and honoring something beautiful from what's been broken. I thought about this and about her strength as I headed home from the last of our three memorial services. My head and heart were full of all of the stories and tears and cards and hugs that I got to witness all last weekend. And suddenly I understood that the reason I couldn't get Jordan out of my mind is that I had not yet made or honored something beautiful from the terrible brokenness of his murder. And so I printed out a color picture of him, and I found a beautiful piece of fabric, and I gathered all the candles that I had stashed in different nooks and crannies of my house, and I made a simple little altar. And then whenever I was home for the next few days, I made sure that all the candles were lit when I was in the house. It would be the height of arrogance to compare my modest spiritual homework, just building a little altar in the corner of my home study, to Lucia McBath's capacity to survive her terrible grief and somehow manage to emerge as a leader. But it felt important that I created something that had some beauty, the candlelight reflecting on the window, the color of the fabric, the vibrancy of his face in the picture. And I created it in honor of his youth, his life, his humanity, and a characteristic he shares with each of us, his human vulnerability.